Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Strike and Ellicott Files, an unofficial podcast dedicated to all things Cormoran Strike and Robin Ellicott, as written by Robert Galbraith. My name is Kenz.
I'm Lindsay.
And I'm Pools.
And today we'll be continuing our reread of The Running Grave, covering chapters 17 through 19 of part 1. Please be aware, as always, that our discussion of The Running Grave will often reference the ending of this book, as well as the rest of the books in the series. But before we start, we have some news. Pools, you want to tell us about it?
Yes, we got our first piece of Book 8 info this morning.
First ever.
First ever. Joe tweeted today saying that Strike just turned 42 in Book 8, on which she's currently working.
Yes, because today's the day after Strike's birthday, so she was retweeting Bill's happy birthday.
Happy birthday to Strike. Obviously, we have to immediately overanalyze and consider all the implications for this.
Obviously.
So this could mean two things. This could mean he turns 42 during the book, and she's currently writing the part that comes after his birthday, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or it could mean that the book begins very soon after his 42nd birthday. Either one would make sense logically with the phrasing. Yeah. But as we know, The Running Grave ends at the very end of September, meaning that it's about 2 months before said birthday. So either way, we're not getting a huge time skip. We're picking up real close after the grenade was dropped.
So exciting.
So exciting.
So excited.
Of course, she could do the thing where she writes a little bit and then there's a little bit of a skip.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I've been saying for a while that I've wanted shorter timelines, mm-hmm. and that's because I just want these two to stop wasting time.
Yeah.
But that fits with what I've hoped for, and it makes sense after the grenade that was dropped. The timelines would be quicker because things are going to happen. They can't go back.
No.
There's no waiting like 8 months. After that grenade.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, I hope not.
Dear God.
I think I saw it was G who asked percentage-wise what's happening.
Where are you if you were buffering? Yeah, that was great.
But I mean, she didn't stick around to answer anything or like anything.
Which is tragic.
I know, but it was still so exciting.
Yes. She knew what that would do to all of us. Yeah. I am very certain she knew exactly what she was doing.
Of course she does.
With that. But I was thinking 42 is a very significant number. Okay, because it's the answer. It's the answer to the question, the meaning of life, the universe, everything. So if you tie the fact that he's just turned 42 in with his revelations in chapter 64 about the meaning of the universe in this book, I think that means he's going to have a very significant birthday / year. Things are going to happen for him.
I'm picking up what you're putting down.
You're picking up what I'm putting down? Thanks, Kenz.
Uh-huh.
I'm with you. I'd like that to happen too, but I don't know what you mean about 42.
Yeah, I know. It's from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which is a very, very famous sci-fi franchise, comedy sci-fi. It's like, it was a radio play and then it was books and then been some very disappointing film adaptations by Douglas Adams. It's absolutely classic. But 42 is the answer, but they didn't think to ask the right question, so they don't know what the answer means, basically.
This is less important, but I was also so interested and happy to know that those pieces of fan art that were included in Bill's tweet are close to how she pictures him. I don't know about you guys, but I'm dying to see just the perfect snapshot of Strike and Robin in her brain and see
how she sees them.
Mm-hmm. The one pencil drawing that was included in that has always been the closest to him in my mind.
Mm-hmm. Same.
So it's always been my favorite piece of fan art. But oh, that was so exciting for me to see that.
Mm-hmm.
Me too.
Hopefully that means that we'll get
a header.
Some new stuff. A header soon. Oh, header can't wait.
Amazing.
And overanalyze the shit out of it.
I think she knows that we're dying for it because so many of us have said, can't wait for a header. Can't wait for a header.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
She has to know.
Yeah.
I think it'll be a Christmas present for us,
that would
maybe.
Be great.
That would be amazing.
Remember last year when she tweeted something about if only I could get to the end of part 6 before she stopped for Christmas, she could breathe.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Now knowing what we know, the ending of part 6, of course she wanted to finish that before she took a break.
Obviously.
Like, how do you... I wouldn't be able to sleep. Oh,
me neither.
Man.
Yeah.
Yeah, it makes so much sense now.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to be keeping an eye on her Twitter header even more obsessively than usual.
Yeah, I've been kind of taking once a day, a little peeky peek.
Mm-hmm.
See what's peek happening over there. A peek and see. That was fun. We haven't done news in a while.
Mm-hmm.
This is great.
I
like getting some news again. It's,
me too.
I hope it keeps coming.
Yeah.
All right. Should we do our Q&A?
Yes.
Yes. So the Q&A for this episode. There are many interwoven relationships in this book. And how do you decide how much to fill out any individual's backstory?
You see, I'm queen of backstory. I love my backstory. I usually know way more backstory than anyone needs on all of my characters. And when it comes to Strike and Robin, that's useful and important because I know where they're coming from always, and I know what may or may not eventually be revealed. And it helps you keep the character consistent if you've really fleshed out their past. So I have a file on my laptop where Strike and Robin's backstories are very fully written. And some of it's appeared in the novels so far. Some of it may never be in there, but I always know where they're coming from and I always know what they would remember and they would feel. On other characters, Pat, for example, I also have quite a lot of backstory. I knew when I created her what her family situation was, how old she was, what her husband was called. So I have little files on all of the constant characters. Yeah, I can't say too much. It's quite frustrating, but I normally know on pretty much every character, I normally know more than anyone else needs to know.
The queen of backstory, she says. Queen in general works for me. Mm-hmm. But listen, she said she knows more backstory than anyone else needs. I do not agree.
No.
I do not concur.
No.
No, I do need it. I need it.
Mm-hmm. I need like encyclopedia.
Yeah. Strike. We need a striclopedia. Mm-hmm. A striclopedia.
Literally. Is much better, yes.
Every single detail. Nothing is too small or unimportant.
It's not that we want it. We need it. Mm-hmm. We do need it, Joe.
Need. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel like we should start a campaign. You know, it can be like the Scottish Book 2.0.
The Scottish Book 2.0. I wonder how much begging would it take for her to show us all of that stuff when the series is over? Because I'm willing.
I'll beg. I have no dignity.
It would be really cool, I feel like, to find little bits of lore and backstory, kind of like how they had on Pottermore.
Yeah.
That would be really cool. And they could have like illustrations and stuff.
I would enjoy that very much. Yeah.
Yeah. It'd be a fun way to find stuff out.
Yeah. It would be really great. On a more serious note, though, I think the most important thing she said here is that she always knows where they're coming from. Because I think this is exactly why these characters feel like such real people to us, is because she does these kind of things. Mm-hmm. Their reactions, opinion, everything, they're based on this elaborate history that she's made for them.
Yeah.
I'm so curious if she created all of this backstory before writing the books, if some of it comes to her as she goes, because it would make sense with how she talks about them as if they're real people. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If she's created this elaborate backstory, I can see how it would feel like this real person is now informing her of what they would do. Yeah. It's really interesting.
I always love seeing into her process. Mm-hmm. Knowing like how she does this. So knowing that she has these extensive backstories for small characters, that's good. She's not just making it up all in the fight, but we knew she did that.
Yeah, of course we do.
Yeah, I think that would be a great thing to ask her.
Put it on the list.
Yes, yeah. Definitely.
I wonder if she has all their futures, not just the near future, but like when they're 70.
After the books are over.
Way after the books are over. Does she know what they're going to do?
I'm sure she does, because I remember someone asking her this about Harry Potter, and she was like, of course, it's me. Of course I know this.
Yeah, of course.
You know? Yeah.
Aww. It's very sweet. Somewhere in her head, they're living married and, I don't know, solving the mysteries in their retirement cottage somewhere. It's very cute.
Well, we know for certain that when Strike is 80, who's going to be there with him? So
yeah.
I think she's telling us that that's their future, you know?
I think so too.
Oh yeah.
Have I said I love them in the last 5 minutes?
It's worth saying again.
Are we just all in cozy little feels?
I'm in my feelings about them.
I just live there.
You getting comfy in the emotions closet over there? Mm-hmm. You got like pillows and blankets and stuff.
You got to do it. It must be done.
Yep.
Does Joe ever feel like these cozy emotions about them?
I think so.
Or is it different for her?
She must.
All right. Should we go to chapter 17?
Yes.
All right. In chapter 17, Strike interviews Henry Worthington Fields. So the epigraph for this chapter. For youthful folly, it is the most hopeless thing to entangle itself in empty imaginings. The more obstinately it clings to such unreal fantasies, the more certainly will humiliation overtake it. And that is from Hexagram 4, Youthful Folly.
So this one seems pretty straightforward to me. I think it's talking about Henry's story of almost joining the UHC. He's telling Strike about a stupid thing he did when he was younger. Mm-hmm. I really like what my header deck says, and I just want to read it, even though I don't think it says anything else about Henry in particular, but it says, "Don't go running after answers as if it's embarrassing not to know. Holding steady to not knowing and hence to learning will bring good results." Then it asks the question, "What if you didn't need to know all the answers now?" Mm-hmm. I always think of Shanker when I hear the word hence.
Your fucking hints.
Off of your fucking hints.
the best. But anyway, I just thought that that was such good advice that maybe young Henry could have used. You know, it's okay not to know everything. You don't need to run off to a cult to try to figure life out.
Connecting the case to the personal, that kind of reminds me of a few lines in chapter 64 when Strike comes to that similar sort of realization that there are some mysteries in this world, like love and death and Charlotte, that are just, you know, unsolvable. They'll never be fully understood, and that's okay. I feel like young Strike probably could have used that advice as well.
Oh, I love that. That's such a beautiful connection, Kenz. It brings me around to one of the final thoughts of the novel, that we have to forgive who we were when we didn't know any better, because everyone is an idiot when they're young. We don't know better. The hexagram reassures us that, I'm quoting from it here, in the time of youth, folly is not an evil. One may succeed in spite of it, provided one finds an experienced teacher. Unfortunately, for the youthful characters in this novel, they found the wrong teacher in Wace. And for Strike and Robin, it seems like only experience could teach them the lessons that they need to learn. Long, long experience. Not 100% sure that both of them have learned their lessons yet.
Who are you looking at there?
I'm looking at Robin right now. I am very anxious about book 8 in terms of what Robin's going to do.
Oh, don't be anxious. It's going to be beautiful.
I know, but
we know where the ending is going to be. So
you're right. Yes.
This is where we start to get into the really, really good shit.
You're right. And you know what? Maybe she has learned her lessons and she's not going to be foolish anymore.
I think that's the entire point. Of course, I think she's still going to struggle and have some fear, right? But what I think for book 8 is that Robin is going to have to face the whole thing about not making the same mistakes twice, which is why I think she mentioned it in the last chapter.
Yes, of course.
And she's going to answer the question that she always asks herself, which is this love?
Yeah.
And she's going to have the answer to that. So it's going to be beautiful.
Right.
It's going to be great.
Thank you, Lindsay. You always reassure me.
I try.
Okay. Now that we're in our feelings again.
All right, let's jump into the chapter. Yeah. I love the start of this chapter where Robin can't resist calling Strike to tell him about her interview with Sheila, because as we know, they're a bit moody with each other since that day in the office where Ilsa called to warn him about sperm stealer Bijou. It's just so typical that it's something about work that breaks the ice here. And it does. It works. Mm-hmm.
Literally every single time. Has there ever been a time when things have been tense between them when work didn't help break the tension? Because I don't think there has been.
No, I don't think so.
I think there's only been a couple instances where it wasn't work. One time, Strike phoned to apologize and didn't use work as an excuse. Mm-hmm. Work works really well for them.
Work works.
Work works.
It does work. So Strike and Robin talk about how awful it is that the UHC didn't get medical help for Brian, just like with Margaret Cathcart Bryce. And they say that it would be difficult to pursue anything legally because they can't prove to a court that either adult did ask for help and they weren't choosing this. I think it's clear that there's a contrast being made to later in the book when Robin sees Jacob, because that wouldn't matter since he's a child. He can't consent to not having medical care, I'm assuming.
I think you're right. Because he's a child, I mean, surely that would probably fall under some sort of duty of care, right?
Plus, they're not just withholding medical care from Jacob. They're actively starving him to death. Like, they stop feeding him. And that's a whole another crime right there, I'm pretty sure.
Murder?
Yes. That's the one, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, that's the ticket.
Nailed it.
It just seems to be like this is an important thing because Jacob is what Robin needs to feel like she has enough when she left.
Yeah.
I know that she didn't have a choice at that point. She had to leave whether she saw Jacob or not, but it does feel like the smoking gun she was looking for the whole time, and it's being set up here, I think.
Yeah. You know, I just realized that the one other time that Robin is closest to leaving the cult is not any of the points where she herself is suffering, and there are some severe ones, but it's when someone else is in danger when giving birth. And then when she does leave, it's to get help for Jacob. That's honestly, that's very on brand for her.
Yeah. I don't think she had a choice.
No, she didn't have a choice.
She had to leave then.
Yeah.
But
her first thought when escaping is we need to get to the police to help Jacob, not to nail the church, but to help that little boy.
Strike tells Robin that he's interviewing Henry Worthington Fields and that Henry has told Strike that they have a mutual friend. Did either of you guess it was Charlotte?
Actually, Charlotte was, that was like immediately who my mind went to. I figured if the mutual friend was being mentioned at all, it's because we've probably already met them. And as far as like upper crust folks we know from these books that in my mind could plausibly be Henry's friend, the only people that I thought that it could be was either Charlotte or maybe Izzy, but I was leaning more towards Charlotte.
I want to talk about Henry really quickly, though, because if you remember, Pools talked a few episodes back about the names of the brothers being repeated from Lethal White. So we have Jimmy and Billy Knight with James and Will Enser, same names. But what is so interesting is that Henry fits with this too. Louise Freeman mentioned this to us, and she wrote about it on her blog, The Farting Sofa, about the 4-7 parallels. So she points out that Henry is also a repeat name in the exact same situations. It's someone Strike interviews who Charlotte uses as a way to get to Strike. Here, we have Henry Worthington Fields, and in Lethal White, we had Henry Drummond, the art dealer. And remember, she shows up pregnant and gets Strike to walk her to Franco's.
Ooh, I love that parallel.
I know, it was really exciting to me when she pointed this out. I was chatting with Louise about this, and she said, the Henry pair passes the specificity test. Charlotte ambushing Strike could be simply an action repeated because she's been wanting him back. An ambush because Charlotte found out he was interviewing a man named Henry from whom she was considering buying expensive home decor. That, I think, must be a specific echo.
Yeah, I think so too. The name Henry means home ruler, which is kind of interesting to me because, like Louise Freeman points out, both of these Henrys sell objects for the home, expensive, fancy antiques, right? Yeah. So one could say they're a kind of ruler for their clients' homes, advising them in matters of taste. But in both cases, it's Charlotte who's the actual ruler in these situations. She's manipulating and using these men to get access to the guy she feels is her home, the man she wants to rule.
Mm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. And you know what? Now that I'm thinking about it, Madeline's son was named Henry too.
Yeah.
He doesn't fit with this, except Charlotte did show up when he was standing there with Henry and his friend.
It's another Henry where Charlotte shows up. Another Henry. This is interesting. So Madeline's Henry, home ruler, has no single home. He has multiple. Mm-hmm. But it's Madeline who's the home ruler there, and she sells artsy decorative objects. And she's the one who works as the conduit for Charlotte to get to Strike. And like you said, Henry himself is there when Charlotte shows up. It's like he's a mini Henry. He's an almost formed vehicle for manipulation, but he's still got some cooking time left.
Yeah, that's really interesting because there have been a couple of times where she's repeated names and I never thought much about it, but this is a pattern.
I hope it doesn't hold for Dennis because I like Dennis Chauncey.
Creed. Dennis Creed.
Don't like that.
Nope, let's take that one out of the equation. Yeah, we're good. But I mean, I guess if they ever meet another Henry, he might be a medium.
Oh my God. Yes, please. I desperately want Strike having to deal with a psychic telling him that Charlotte's calling from the other side and wants a quick chat. That would make my life.
That would be hilarious.
Yes, please.
Ridiculous, but so hilarious. Funny. He'd be so annoyed on multiple levels.
Multiple. She's still calling even though she's fucking dead. Oh my God. Tell her to leave a message and I'll delete it later.
Oh, that's so funny.
Oh, okay.
All right, so moving on though. Robin doesn't tell Strike that Sheila remembered him from the commune and she assumes that he didn't want to talk about it since he hadn't told her. I'm just wondering how you both think that he would have reacted if she had mentioned it. I know it says that he's unaware of how close he'd come to a conversation he didn't want to have, but I'm just kind of wondering how he would have responded.
I feel like Robin, being the tactful person that she is, I feel like she probably could have brought it up in a way that was sensitive and didn't, I don't know, make him feel defensive. Though for some reason, that doesn't seem like the sort of thing you'd share with somebody over the phone, does it? Oh, by the way, a witness mentioned seeing you and your family living in a commune that turned into the cult we're investigating. You know, it just seems like the sort of, it definitely seems like the sort of thing message best conveyed in person.
Yeah, I don't think he'd have been like angry. He'd have been caught off guard. So he probably would have been pretty short with her in his response.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
He'd give her even less info about it than he did. I'm thinking of the Career of Evil scene where she has to like pry the initial info about each suspect out of him in the pub.
That level of
tight-lippedness. Mm-hmm. Is that a word? Tight-lippedness. Sure. I like it. But yeah, you know, he'd have felt guilty for being short or snapping at her later and maybe gone back and told her more, I think.
Yeah.
I agree. She'd have been tactful. She is so tactful. Maybe sometimes a little too tactful.
I agree.
Like, be nosy, Robin. Damn it.
Just ask some questions, Robin.
Like, we know she's nosy. She just needs to be more Does obvious it show about it, it sometimes.
Okay, so I know I just asked a bit ago if either of you guessed that Charlotte was the mutual friend, but I think this is a clue saying that it is, because when it says that Strike had been to this pub before, It says it had been a favorite of Charlotte's and her well-heeled friends.
I love that this pub is called the Grenadier, because a Grenadier was an explosive.
I'm so glad you pronounced it and not me.
I didn't check that pronunciation. I'm just going off what I think it should be in French. So who knows? It was an explosive specialist soldier who threw the hand grenades in sieges. Mm. And then they eventually became like the vanguard units that would storm fortifications and stuff. And in the modern army, they're armed with like grenade launchers and shit. I just think it's interesting because Charlotte is coming in to drop a bomb on Strike to lay siege to his fortifications. She's the Grenadier. Mm-hmm. But of course, at the end of this book, Strike lobs a grenade of his own.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah.
And that's the kind we like.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. And interesting that Charlotte wants something explosive from him, but he just gives her nothing.
Yeah. The grenade she's lobbing are duds. They're faulty.
They are.
They're not.
Yep. Wah, wah. Sorry, wah, Charlotte. Wah. We started talking about how the place someone picks to meet Strike or Robin reflects them. Mm-hmm. But we know that Henry didn't pick this one. Charlotte says in the next chapter that she suggested the pub. So with that in mind, I'm wondering how this either reflects Charlotte or what were her intentions for picking this. It says that the inside was decorated with military prints and paintings. Knowing Charlotte, I'm wondering if this was intentional to maybe put Strike in the mindset of the old days.
Ooh, I like that. To me, it almost seemed like a combination of the two of them. So you have the military stuff for Strike, and you have all of the money and stuff tacked on the ceiling for Charlotte, which is a tenuous connection, but
I like it. And then, of course, there's the ghost story.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the book gives us a pretty full account of it. So it says there's money stuck up on the ceiling that's meant to pay the debt for this ghost who is beaten to death after cheating at cards, which seems excessive. But
yeah,
I'm trying to connect this to Charlotte.
All right. Well, it's not quite the same, but we do see some mention in Lethal White of that time that Strike went with Charlotte and her brothers to the Epsom Derby, and she wins a bunch of money placing bets on the horses.
Mm, she's a gambler. She's a gamer. You know what? She does play games, and she cheats. She cheats at the game.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
Also, how annoying was she in that chapter, in that memory?
Ugh.
I was so annoyed with her.
Oh, ridiculous. So rude. So mean. Mm-hmm. Awful. Now I'm just thinking about how cute Carmen and Robin's visit was.
Mm-hmm. I know. It's my favorite Lethal White chapter.
Anyway, thoughts on this ghost. At the end of their conversation in the next chapter, Strike demolishes the founding myth of their relationship, that he would forever be grateful and loyal to her for coming to him after he lost his leg. So in Charlotte's eyes, that was a debt that Strike would never have been able to fully pay. And she's been sort of haunting him for it ever since, right?
Ooh, yeah, she has. Yeah. Like that.
Also, one might say that Henry himself won't ever be able to pay his debt to Flora because he was the one who brought her to the UHC. So it was a tiny action that basically ruined her life. And I think he's haunted by the guilt of that. He's never going to be able to make that up to her.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I'm glad I brought up the ghost story.
Me too.
I like the ghost story.
I love
story,
making
yeah.
very tenuous connections too.
To ghost stories and pubs.
Yeah.
We did it last time, didn't we?
Did we?
There was that one ghost in Ink Black Heart.
The barmaid.
Yeah, and the Americans are talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I had a good first impression of Henry. I thought he seemed kind but nervous. I was betting that his little joke about thinking that Strike would be hiding behind a newspaper with the eye holes cut out was probably something he planned ahead to ease his nerves. Like, I'm going to say this. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's how I was imagining it.
Strike's response is hilarious, though. Oh, no, only when I'm walking.
Yeah, I know. Because then you picture it. And it's so funny. Like... I mean, maybe Henry isn't the best judge of character if you think Charlotte's so great. Yeah. But I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, if he only knows her as he's the guy she's buying antiques from, I'm sure she does seem perfectly lovely. Yeah. She turns on the charm to get a deal or get the best chairs. I don't know.
The best chairs?
I don't know what rich people buy. And, you know, and if he hasn't been part of her social scene, he's never gotten close enough to her to see the real her. It makes sense that he'd like her.
Anyway, speaking of Charlotte, I just wanted to try and get in her head a little bit. I know it's a scary place
in there.
But here's where Henry tells Strike that Charlotte is their mutual friend and that he called her to ask if Strike was a good guy and okay to talk to. I have no doubt that Charlotte saw this as an opportunity to surprise Strike and show up, not, oh yes, he really is such a good guy.
Oh yeah. If there is an opportunity to try and manipulate Strike, she's gonna take it.
Absolutely. Yes.
What do you think about Henry's approach regarding Flora? So he says the condition of talking to Strike is that Strike doesn't go after her because she's still not right.
I thought it was sweet that he was trying to be sensitive towards how she would feel about talking about this stuff again, especially since he knew about her suicide attempt. But
yeah,
that also told me immediately that we, meaning the readers, were going to end up meeting her later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting that Henry makes this a condition of him talking, only because, I mean, try to follow me here. I mean, it's going to be hard because this is nonsense.
Oh, here we go.
But logically, talking to Flora.
Sorry, you said logically.
Logically.
Try to follow me here. Logically.
Okay. Talking to Flora would be much more important for their investigation, right? Because she was at the church so much longer. She has the real dirt. Right. Mm-hmm. So Henry trying to use himself as leverage when he's not the valuable chip here.
Right.
So, I mean, it's a good thing that Strike clearly doesn't consider himself bound by his agreement here. I don't think he once remembers promising Henry this later.
Oh, I didn't either.
No, neither did I. No one took this promise seriously.
But I guess Flora wanting to talk makes it all irrelevant anyway.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Very true. Because Henry, like Prudence, kind of underestimates Flora and doesn't understand what will actually help her.
It's kind of sad. She has all these people around her being like, no, no,
I know.
No. Reminds me of Robin a little bit.
Yeah, it does. And then Robin becomes that person for Flora. Oh, man.
Yeah.
Okay. I can't wait to get to that chapter.
Oh, I loved Flora.
I loved Flora a lot. Me too. I want her and Robin to stay friends. I have a whole headcanon that we'll get to there.
Okay. So Henry tells the story of how he and Flora ended up at Chapman Farm. Henry says a guy named Joe recruited him in a bar. And I know this Joe guy comes up later on. Is there anything worth pointing out about him now?
Something interesting to me was Strike. He knows how odd it is that Joe is at this bar when alcohol isn't allowed in the church. We know now that this just fits, you know, the larger pattern of hypocrisy where the church leaders are allowed to drink. And, you know, it also fits the fact that the church's actual stance on homosexuality is it doesn't exist. It's not allowed. But it exists when we can recruit people with it. Because what I was thinking is, with the church's tactic of preying on the vulnerable, I bet that you can find a lot of young gay people in not great home situations at a bar like this, right? And they would make good prey.
I think you're right.
A bit depressing.
I'm really interested in what you think about the part where Henry explains that he and Flora felt like Jonathan Wace understood what it was like to be different. The full line is, there's a lot of likes in it, so sorry. Like, he got what it's like to be, what it feels like not to be, like to be different, you know? Or maybe you don't, I don't know, Henry added with a laugh and a shrug. I guess I'm just kind of wondering if you think that Strike understands this feeling.
I don't know. I mean, Henry growing up gay, I don't know, can Strike really know that feeling? I mean, he's got his own childhood experience of being Rokeby's son to feel singled out and different, and his more recent experience as an amputee. But those are all very different dimensions of the sort of the feeling of being different. I don't know.
I would say that I do think Strike understands this feeling, especially when he was growing up. Because yes, Henry is talking about his experience of being gay, but I think that people can experience the same feelings in different ways. Mm-hmm. I think about kids Strike showing up at a new school with a different accent, a mother who was who she was, Rokeby, like you said. And then there's that line about making friends with kids who had permanent bedrooms. Oh. That's a line that's always haunted me and breaks my heart. Mm-hmm. So yeah, he didn't experience the same kind of feeling different, but I do think he felt different from other kids when he was growing up.
Yeah, you know, I think you're right about that. I had forgotten about that permanent bedrooms line. So thanks for bringing that back.
Yeah, I can't forget it. It's just, it's
ouch.
So...
ouch.
Yeah, that one hurts.
I'm really most intrigued by how Wace managed to make Henry and Flora feel this way about him, because I didn't get any elements of that kind of feeling of difference from the speeches that we see. So have his techniques changed over the years, or do people with different perspectives just draw something different from what he says and does?
That feels likely to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, he's such a good manipulator that maybe he's able to adjust himself depending on who he's talking to, or it does seem likely that people would take things a way that they want to see in it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But the entire description Henry gives about the UHC is spot on. It's everything that we see happen with Robin. Never a minute alone, always working, the chanting, not being able to think, the fasting, starting to feel like you want their approval.
Yeah.
All the talk about social justice and changing the world, the baptism, all of it, we see all of that happen.
It all sounds so horrible. I was really worried for Robin reading this little preview of what's to come. But then I realized this is just the first week where the cult is still showing their best face. This is just the tip of the iceberg of horrors at this farm.
I am really glad I didn't realize that when I was first reading the book, because that would have been terrifying. And I was already...
All that in just 1 week. The one week where you're not committed yet? Oh my God, she's in trouble.
So glad we know the ending of this book that it's okay. Yeah, it's okay. It's okay. We have to remind myself every once in a while. It's okay. She's fine.
Just go reread the rescue chapter. I know. Very long hugs.
Anyway, and during this talk, he explains that he was kind of into it until an incident with a pregnant woman caused him to change his mind. First of all, extremely concerning that a heavily pregnant woman was made to work the fields like this. Mm-hmm. Can't imagine. It's just horrifying to read that when she doubles over in pain, everyone just starts chanting. Yeah. I was horrified by this.
You would think that they would take better care of the women that they're using as baby incubators, considering that they're literally getting their money from trafficking babies. But I guess nobody here thought to read The Handmaid's Tale, you know?
Ugh. I wonder how many, you know, maternal, fetal, and infant deaths were caused by medical negligence and abuse, not only during childbirth, but during the entire pregnancy at this cult. Because I doubt that any of these women were given prenatal vitamins. There was clearly no care given to any physical limitations. I doubt they were properly monitored for stuff like preeclampsia. It seems foolish of the UHC from a profit-oriented perspective, like you said, Kenz.
I guess they just figure it's not worth the risk of having outside care because someone might say something. I feel like they just think, well, if one dies, we'll just do another.
Jeez.
No, it's awful.
God.
But I would not be surprised if a lot of those bodies that they end up digging up are pregnant women, women who have died in birth, infants.
I also would not be surprised in the slightest.
But really, here's just another instance of pregnancy in this book. There have already been so many references to pregnancy, even this early on, that in hindsight, I think it's just all a big clue to that reveal at the end about what's really going on at Chapman Farm.
Yeah, it super is. This is also a big pointer to one of the biggest crimes the UHC committed, because this woman is Deirdre, who's pregnant with Lynn. So Mazu just angrily staring at her in a creepy way makes sense, because we know Mazu hates the women that Jonathan Wace is interested in. Deirdre is one of those women.
Yeah, at this point, would she have already accused him of the rape? Because that might partially explain why people were hesitant to help her. Because if she was on the outs, you know.
Yeah, that would make sense.
Going back to Henry and Flora, he explains that they were separated. It's a smart and awful tactic by the UHC to separate friends this way, not allow them to talk to each other. Because you have to wonder if Henry had been able to share his doubts and feelings with her, if she would have left with him.
Yeah.
What ends up happening to those two friends who are on the same bus as Robin?
I believe that one of them joins and one of them leaves. So Penny, the green-haired one, is the one who joins the church. And then her blonde friend who cried when she had to remove her piercings never gets baptized, and we don't see her again.
Yeah, so maybe a bit of a reflection there.
Oh, the cycle's happening all over again.
When Henry talks about the night of the baptism, it's so sad. We know that the UHC uses peer pressure and fear to get people to comply, but it's a whole other thing for me when I was actually reading about it happening. And I think the reason it's so compelling is we as readers are instantly put in Henry's shoes, wondering how we would do in this situation.
Yeah.
I like to think I could be brave enough to be like the woman ahead of him who said no, but if you're scared they might do something to you, I don't know.
Yeah.
The power of social pressure is terrifying to me, because there have been multiple studies that show that people will give a clearly wrong answer to a question that they know is wrong rather than go against a group of pre-planted members who deliberately answer wrong. One study did an MRI on the participants, and the results suggested that people who caved to the peer pressure literally changed their own perception of reality rather than go against the group. We're a very social species, and social pressure works on us. But as a consolation, these same studies show that not everyone will cave. Some people will answer the truth of what they're perceiving. It might sound arrogant, but I feel like I wouldn't have joined. I feel like I'd say no. I'm pretty confident, you know?
I mean, I think we all hope that's the case.
Yeah.
I think the fear of staying in might have overruled the fear of saying no for me.
Yeah.
But I'd just be such a terrible cult member. I really would, because I don't do well with rules or authority who haven't earned it, mm-hmm. or rules that don't make sense. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not even a good employee because of those things.
Yeah.
When I worked for Toys R Us, one time they decided that instead of just greeting people like a normal human being, that you had to say, "What can I help you find today?" Oh, and I was like, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
I'm not doing that at all. I'm not doing it.
I am right there with you, Lindsay. I am also a terrible employee. Yes. For all the same reasons. Like, I don't respect authority. If it's a stupid rule or an immoral rule, I'm not going to follow it because you can't make me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I do like rules, and authority is fine if it's justified and
makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Also, I'm very lazy. And I like food. I like protein. I'd have dipped out of there after 2 days of eating ramen and canned tomatoes and having to like work in a field. I'm like, no, in the sun with my skin, I'm out. Bye. Nope. Like, I'll walk to Elmerton or whatever. This isn't happening. Mm-hmm. So no, I don't think we'd be good candidates for this cult.
Yeah, I'd have a hard time with that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's not the kind of authority that I think deserves respect, obviously.
Yeah.
Okay, so here's a little something that I hadn't picked up on before. Mazu takes Henry and the other woman who said no to an empty room with no beds and bars on the window and tells them they'll have to stay there until the next day to catch the minibus. I bet there have been a lot of people who have caved in that room mm-hmm. and ended up staying because it's the worst kind of mind game.
I don't think anything could convince me to even step into that room. Like, I'd be way too afraid of getting locked in. No thanks. I'll just walk down the road and just set out on foot. If it takes all night, so be it. Better to spend the night walking than in this creepy ass prison.
I know. Well, the room is probably worse than a prison cell because there are no beds and I doubt there's a toilet.
Ugh.
The entire time that somebody is in there, they still don't know if they're going to be allowed to leave, if they're safe. This is a full on kidnapping.
Oh man.
This is crazy.
It is. God, I hadn't even thought about it like that. That's horrifying.
I know. And we still don't really know what happens to people who say no and who get put in this room. They have to eventually let them go.
I think they do let them go if people were disappearing regularly after a week.
No, of course.
Yeah.
But we don't know when it happens. We don't know what happens to them in that room. We don't know if there's more pressure put on them. Like, we don't know these things. It's just awful.
Yeah.
So Henry tells Strike about meeting up with Flora after she escaped. The important bit is, of course, I think that Flora had said she'd seen someone killed.
Yeah. That's a pretty big thing. It's strange to me that Strike doesn't make tracking down and speaking to Flora a priority after hearing this, because even if it did turn out to be some kind of hallucination or trick, on the off chance that it wasn't, that would be their smoking gun right there, right? But after he mentions her name to Neve in an upcoming chapter, we don't get a single mention of him trying to find her or talk to her until chapter 95 when he ties her to Torment Town.
Maybe he was trying to keep his word to Henry at first and find other things he can use.
Maybe. It's just, it seems so weird.
But anyway, I hope that Flora and Henry can, if not find their friendship, at least that he can feel better and doesn't feel so guilty.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to imagine that what Strike and Robin achieve in this book will help with that.
I hope so.
I really love the theme of justice helping with healing in this book, if you haven't noticed.
I hadn't. Wow.
It's great.
It's a very delicious theme.
As Henry walked towards the door, a dark woman entered the pub, and with anger and a sense of absolute inevitability, Strike recognized Charlotte Ross.
Dun, dun, dun.
I know.
All right, chapter 18. Charlotte intercepts Strike after his interview with Henry.
I like intercepts. That's good.
Football thing, as I've learned.
I'm just imagining her like catching Strike. It's a very heavy football. Okay, so the epigraph, thunder and wind, the image of duration. Thus the superior man stands firm and does not change his direction. And that's from hexagram 32, duration. Reading this epigraph for the first time was a little unique in that we were already told what was about to happen with that final line from the previous chapter telling us that Charlotte had walked in. So I remember reading this epigraph and thinking, thank God, when I read this.
Mm-hmm.
And not that I ever thought that he wouldn't stand firm, you know, because he's proven to us so many times that he will. But it was still nice to be told ahead of time. I was excited about this one.
Yeah, I was too. This epigraph was so tricky for me to grasp onto because it represents the institution of marriage as the enduring union of the sexes, which is definitely not what's going on here with Corman and Charlotte, right?
No.
There's a quote in the judgment that says, "Thunder rolls and the wind blows. Both are examples of extreme ability and so are seemingly the very opposite of duration. But the laws governing their appearance and subsistence, their coming and going endure. In the same way, the independence of the superior man is not based on rigidity and immobility of character. He always keeps abreast of the time and changes with it. What endures is the unswerving directive, the inner law of his being, which determines all his actions." And this was really interesting to me because Charlotte is the thunder in the wind here, right? She's the chaos battering at him while he stands firm. But for Cormoran, she has always been a predictable and familiar chaos. The laws governing her appearance, he knows them. He knows what to expect with her, which is why he stayed with her so long, right? Why they almost came close to that marriage. But Cormoran is the superior man, which means that although he is stable and he has this duration, he also changes. The inner laws of his being are guiding him away from Charlotte's chaos and onto a new path, the real duration of marriage that this hexagram represents.
No, I think you're totally right. Mm-hmm. Charlotte is the known chaos, but Strike is holding firm in his decision to never go back to her.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, the hexagram's about marriage. Maybe this is one of those times where the larger meaning doesn't apply.
Yeah.
Probably an argument that it's only the lines Joe chooses that applies. Won't stop us from looking.
Nope. Literally nothing could stop me from reading into the larger context that the lines right. appear in. Absolutely nothing.
But these lines are very fitting.
Oh.
For that.
Super fitting, yeah. Some wind and thunder coming up. But Strike's house is made of bricks. Be blown down now. He's got a brick house. He's built like a brick house.
You gonna sing the song?
Nope. Okay. Not gonna sing it. Not gonna all do right. it.
Just checking.
I'm staying strong.
The opening line said that Strike had been suspecting that Charlotte was going to show up. And I can't remember if I had thought this too.
Yeah, I don't either. But the second she does, we're like, of course yeah. Charlotte's yeah. here. Absolute inevitability, obviously.
If only we had caught on to the Henry thing sooner.
I know, then we could have really nailed it. But we'll be on the lookout. Well, no, we won't, because she's...
for a Henry medium.
We'll be on lookout for psychic Henry, yeah.
Yeah. I take a little bit of joy in the fact that the only reason Strike agrees to sit down for 5 minutes is because he didn't want her to make a scene and have it end up in the press. Mm-hmm. Like, he just has nothing left for her. That's all he cared about.
It's like he says in the ending, there's nothing better than dead love.
I'm really interested in reading this chapter in parallel with that scene in Franco's that you mentioned earlier, Lindsay, the one in Lethal White, ooh. Where Charlotte traps Strike into sitting with her using much the same kind of social pressure. Social pressure, just like what the cult uses. But I think there are some echoes of that part in Lethal White in this scene. But the really great part of reading them in parallel is seeing how much has changed in Strike. Like, absolutely.
I'm excited.
Everyone go back to Lethal White, read the scene in Franco's, come back and read this chapter because it's amazing.
I rolled my eyes so hard when Charlotte said that she wouldn't ask him to talk if it wasn't important. I was like, oh, come on.
Like, sure, Jen, sure. The lie detector test determined that was a lie.
Okay, so this might sound strange, but I want to talk about Charlotte's clothes. So she's wearing a dark green dress with a heavy black belt. Mm-hmm. And we know that Charlotte puts a ton of thought into what she's wearing, especially, I'm assuming, when she knows she's about to see Strike. Mm-hmm. And I can't help but wonder why she chose this. And I'm also remembering the time she saw Robin in her green dress and correctly guessed that Strike liked Robin. I'm wondering if that plays a role in her choices at all.
Yeah, I think there's something there. And we know that Charlotte puts a lot of thought into her appearance and the image that she produces to other people. So I think that her dressing in green was definitely intentional.
So when you mentioned this, I went back through the other books to check. And in every other single in-person appearance Charlotte makes, she only ever wears black, beige, cream, brown, white, and gray. Only neutrals, always.
Interesting.
Yeah. This book is the very first time we've ever seen her wear color. And more interestingly, every time we see her in this book, including in pictures in the press, she's wearing color. First, she wears a red slip dress, then she wears this green one, then a clinging gold one. And this is such a radical departure from her usual image that I think it definitely means something.
That's interesting.
Yeah. One thought I have is that these sudden colors are like a warning sign, flashing neon signals, red flags that something has changed or escalated. Like, we're approaching that final climactic blow up. It's a fireworks show and the sky's about to light up with color, right? Or maybe she's become so unwell that she's begun using color in her wardrobe to distract people from actually seeing what's happening with her. Like it's a flashy distraction.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Something's going on there with her. But in regards to Charlotte and Green, we do see her associated with Green once before. And that was with the emerald choker that Madeline designs and has her model. So her picture in that emerald choker is staring down at Strike and Madeline when they argue at the jewelry show. And it's the same picture that's used by the newspapers after she dies.
Yeah.
And Green is associated with jealousy. Is this choker and the dress a symbol of her jealousy over Strike, specifically directed at Robin and Robin doppelgangers? Is it that jealousy, her realization that she's lost Strike to Robin, being what pushes her over the edge?
Yeah, maybe.
Mm.
It's interesting because people often talk about Robin's green dress as a symbol of Matthew's jealousy.
Yeah.
Yes. I don't know how that connects here, but...
No, it does.
Something.
And Matthew ripped the green dress and he got booted out.
Yeah, I do have to point out one thing, though. I know this isn't a time we've actually seen Charlotte, so your point still stands. Mm-hmm. But Strike remembers that blue wrap dress that he liked.
Oh, yeah.
It's weird that she never chose to wear that when she's meeting him, something that he liked.
No, you know what? I think this actually makes it even better because that flashback, that's from the past. And I think the fact that she doesn't wear blue again, I think it represents the fact that she can no longer actually connect with him. She no longer has a hold on him because she's not what he wants. He's not hers anymore. So her blue dresses are only in the past, in his memories, where his love is.
Yeah.
Ooh. That makes sense. That makes big sense.
I like that. Going back to our connection of blue.
Yeah, I think we nailed it, guys. I think we did it.
Interesting, though. I'd be really interested to hear what some people have to say about Charlotte's clothing and the colors that she chooses to wear and why it's different. That's a really good spot that you got, that she's never worn color before.
Like, I don't remember colors again. So I went back and I think I found every one, and her outfit is always described as being neutrals.
Okay, so I know we've already said in our review episode that we don't believe Charlotte had cancer, and that's still true for me. Mm-hmm. I don't believe it now after reading this book, but at first I wasn't sure.
I didn't believe it for a second. Strike's first instinct being that she's lying, and then her saying yes too quickly, that's a lying signal. I would bet money that they maybe found something in a mammogram that they needed to test and they've scheduled her. She's immediately spinning that into, I definitely have cancer.
Yeah, I think at this point in the book, I was actually thinking that it could be possible because it could have been a way for her to be killed off, especially since I went in looking for troubled blood parallels and having someone else die from cancer seemed like it could be one of them. Also, I felt like we had two people with cancer, possibly, so Angel and Charlotte. And if I had to pick one of the two who was going to make it out, it wasn't going to be Charlotte.
Yeah, we don't want it to be Charlotte.
No, yeah. I was wondering if this was going to be a way that Charlotte was going to die.
Well, you were right about the dying.
I was right about the dying, yeah.
Going back to my lethal white scene echoes here, the scene in Franco's. In both of these scenes, Charlotte uses sickness and her physical condition to play for sympathy. So in Lethal White, she uses being pregnant and unwell to trap Strike in the first place, and then plays on how miserable she is being pregnant for sympathy. Like she's trying to press his buttons with her supposed earlier pregnancy and her miscarriage. But here, it's the claim that she has breast cancer that she's just trying to draw Strike in and gain his sympathy. And the big difference is how little Strike is affected by this here. She has zero impact. He's not drawn in at all. It just is not working anymore.
I know. I love the line that says that Strike wasn't moved by her tears. Mm-hmm. Because we know that Charlotte, in all her attempts to get him back, she's always played on emotions and been able to move him. And I don't just mean, you know, tugging at his heartstrings or something, but we see her move him to anger more than anything. Mm-hmm. In that scene in Lethal White, and even in the last book, he was the angriest we've ever seen him in Ink Black Heart.
Yeah.
Brought out a real bad side of him, right? But here, nothing. He wasn't moved. He wasn't moved to tenderness. He wasn't moved to love. He wasn't moved to sadness or anger. Just nothing.
It's kind of incredible that we've gotten to this point. Remember how back in Silkworm, Strike was thinking that Charlotte was like a virus in his blood that he doubted that he would ever be able to get rid of. And then again in Lethal White, when he was thinking in that same scene you were just talking about how no one else could provoke him to anger quite like she could, he has come so far. And again, I'm so proud of him.
The difference between this scene and the Franco scene in Lethal White is stark, because there he is drawn in by her. She presses his buttons and he falls back into arguments about their relationship that you can tell they've had 100 times, right? And he instantly gets emotionally invested in them again. But here it's just platitudes from him. He genuinely wishes her well. He hopes she'll be okay. And that's it. And it makes me think again about that point I made in another episode about arguments and relationships. Like, do you not argue because you don't disagree or because it's not worth the effort? And Charlotte just isn't worth the effort for him anymore. He saves all his arguments to have with Robin now, which is why I love when they argue.
They're always productive.
Yeah, and they do it because it matters.
One of my favorite things about Jo's characterization of Strike is how she's chosen to portray how this vice-like grip that Charlotte has had on Strike has gradually sort of loosened over time as he's matured and moved on. And obviously now, as he's learning for himself what love in all of the aspects of his life is supposed to feel like, it makes a lot of sense that these previous tactics that she might have used not only don't work, but don't even elicit even the slightest bit of emotional reaction. Like I said, I'm very proud of this 41-year-old fictional man.
He's done so good.
This whole bit where he tells her that he hopes she's okay for her kids, and she's outraged by this, saying, "That's it?" It seems to me like Charlotte's delusion about their relationship is really on display here in a way that I don't know if we've seen before. Maybe.
Yeah, I feel like there's a bit of vulnerability in this display of her delusion that we haven't seen before.
I think she thought that even if he wasn't immediately sympathetic and scared for her, that she could at least draw him in by accusing him of thinking that she's lying. Because in the past, he would have argued back about how often she has lied. And then they're right back into the same old high drama, high passion back and forth. She tries that. She says, "So you think I'm lying?" And he just says, "No, that would be a horrible thing to do." Even if he was thinking it, he doesn't say it. He's like, "Go be with your loved ones."
I love that he says, "Go be with your loved ones," because the implication is that it ain't him.
Ouch.
Yeah, I think it's really funny how transparent this plan that Charlotte's trying to use to manipulate Strike, because, you know, it's probably worked on him and other people in the past before. You know, first she's trying to draw him in by talking about Henry and then trying to butter him up by paying him a compliment. It just seems really obvious she was hoping to, like, control the flow of the conversation for a more quietly dramatic sort of reveal of, "I have cancer." The fact that Strike ruins it by telling her to cut to the chase is just wonderful, because he knows better.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if it's possible to understand her believing that they'd get back together before that final break in the bond in Ink Black Heart, before he walked away and left her in the street, compared to now. It's just,
I don't know, the depths of her delusion know no bounds, it seems.
I guess I'm just thinking that the majority of the time that they've been apart now, she's been married. So maybe she thinks that that is the biggest thing keeping him from coming back. Maybe she's been given renewed hope now that her divorce is final. And now she's shocked that he still doesn't want her, even with the cancer story. I don't know. Maybe it's nonsense, but no. I'm just trying to figure out her level of delusion and what she's...
I think that totally tracks with her thought process. Because last time she saw him, it was a whole scene and Jago was there. And he specifically mentioned not wanting to raise Jago's kids. So I bet she thought, well, okay, fine. I'll get Jago in the rearview mirror. I'll publicly date the super wealthy guy to make Strike jealous again that I'm moving on or whatever. I'll party it up like I don't have kids. I won't mention them to him or anywhere. Maybe if I do that, he'll forget that they exist. To her, that might seem like a pretty solid plan.
Charlotte logic.
Charlotte logic, yeah. It's just such a low blow for her to use this fake cancer, but even more so to compare it to Strike's very real trauma of losing his leg and almost dying in an explosion. Just to quote it, she says, "This is life and death. I mean, that makes a person, you remember," she whispered, staring into his eyes, "after you got your leg blown off. I mean, my God, it makes you realize what's important. After that, you wanted me, didn't you? Wasn't I the only person in the world you wanted then?"
Just the unmitigated fucking gall of this woman.
This is another echo of the Franco scene in Lethal White, because it comes up there too. Strike is the one who mentions it there, suggesting that she just showed up for the drama, and she responds with, "You bastard, that's how you explain me taking care of you all these months afterwards." But now she's desperate and she's trying to draw him in with it.
I like that you're comparing these two chapters, because it feels like the parallels are very clear. It reminds me of, I mean, this is obviously the less romantic version of this, but it reminds me of chapter, 40 of Career of Evil and chapter 45 of Troubled Blood.
Yeah.
Lay them out next to each other. You should write it up, post it.
I might do.
Was I the only one whose jaw just dropped straight to the floor when he said, "Did I? Or did I just take what was on offer because it was easiest?"
Oh, no way. Minded to.
I wanted to high five him.
Oh my God. Yeah. I think I was as shocked as Charlotte was. I was like, oh my God, man is savage.
Isn't this the exact thing that we've seen Strike do over and over with women in these books? take what's on offer because it's easiest. He's consistently followed the path of least resistance until it's not easy anymore, and then he leaves. And Charlotte, because of how familiar she is, how deeply ingrained the patterns of that relationship are, was easy, even though she was also a nightmare. She was a nightmare that he knew. She was one that felt right. But now he's almost at the point of realization that he wants what is actually right, not what is easy.
Love the Dumbledore nod there. Yes.
You will always get my Harry Potter references.
But seriously, this is a huge moment that might be a little underrated, because comparing how he's describing the hospital moment now to what he said in Cuckoo's Calling, this is no longer a Kairos moment. It's no longer the most beautiful moment of his life.
Nope.
Now it's just what was easy. If we're going back into Charlotte's head, how do you think this moment changes her strategy and her, well, downward spiral up until 64?
It feels like it's finally starting to dawn on her that Strike really isn't coming back and doesn't love her anymore. But truly, the phone call with her where he says that they were never friends is the beginning of the end for her.
I agree with you, Kenz. At that moment was the clincher. And it was after that phone call that the angry, drunken messages escalated. I think that this moment here with what he does shakes her very deeply, because she clearly also believed that this was their Kairos moment, the moment that left Strike forever indebted to her, the moment that ensured he would always come back. And now he's questioned that. He's taken that away from her. I think that's when the doubts and the fears start to really creep in. And for me, it has some real shades of Robin telling Matthew that she was falling out of love with him in university, that they wouldn't have ever gotten married if she hadn't been raped, before she walks out for good, because she shatters that shared belief about their past there too.
Yeah. And doesn't Robin think, I can't remember if it's Lethal White or Trouble Blood, that she felt that Matthew thought she was indebted to him?
Yeah.
I guess it's one thing you can give Matthew, that he isn't Charlotte level crazy.
There's that.
The bar's low.
He got to his feet before she could recover herself enough to retaliate and walked out, half expecting a beer glass to hit him on the back of the head. By a happy stroke of providence, a vacant black cab slid into view as he stepped out onto the pavement, and barely 2 minutes after he'd left her, he was speeding away back towards Denmark Street.
I can't help but associate Denmark Street with Robin in this instance. I know that might not be right because it's literally his home, but there really is a strong sense of that being their place.
Denmark Street definitely very much is their place. And it just kind of reminds me of the ending when they're talking about that file. This belongs here.
This belongs here, just like she does. Yeah, no, I fully agree, Kenz. And not to belabor the point, but going back to, again, to that Franco scene in Lethal White, at the end of that, he left. He felt as though he was pursued, as though Charlotte had projected a succubus that would tail him until they met again. Here, the only thing he's worried about pursuing him is a flying mug. It's not about what he's leaving behind at all, because it is genuinely in the past. It's what he's heading towards that matters in the ending of this chapter. That's where it ends with him.
Yeah.
Anyway, chapter 19.
In chapter 19, Robin gets recruited to the UHC.
And the epigraph to this chapter reads, "Nine at the top means the standstill comes to an end." And that's from hexagram 12, standstill, stagnation.
This is another one that seems really straightforward to me. So Robin's been trying to get recruited, and I can see how you can think of it as a standstill. They can't really move forward that much until it happens, and now it has. The judgment says that a standstill doesn't just end of its own accord, that you have to work for it to end. And I think we can apply that to Robin, because she's put a lot of work into getting recruited.
Absolutely she has, and it's paying off. The ending of this line is interesting as well. It says, "Continuous effort is necessary to maintain peace. Left to itself, it would change into stagnation and disintegration. This shows the creative attitude that man must take if the world is to be put in order," which I think speaks to the fact that Robin's work is nowhere near done at this point. She is just starting. She's done all this work, and now she can finally start doing the real horrible work.
Yep, I guess so.
Buckle up.
So we start the chapter with Robin at a UHC meeting, and Tayo is the one speaking this time. We've talked a lot before about how when a man is described as handsome in a J.K. Rowling book, that we shouldn't really trust him. It always seems like a bad sign. But this description of Tayo is very much the opposite of handsome. But comparing him to a rat instantly had the same effect on me.
Yeah.
Like, nope. Nope. Mm-mm.
I think that Peter Pettigrew has us all very primed to distrust the rat man. We're like,
that's
no,
possible.
I'm on to you. I know.
That's very possible. Yes, the rat man thing, but also the way he approaches Robin. He places and keeps his hand on her lower back.
Ugh.
even Robin thinks in that moment that says that she experienced a spasm of dislike. Mm-hmm. This entire chapter was setting me up to be very afraid of Tayo, very disgusted by him, especially when it came to the sexual interest he clearly had in Robin.
Oh yeah, it really was. I think it's probably fair to say that we all experienced that same mm-hmm. spasm of dislike that Robin experiences towards Tayo in that moment.
Yeah. Listen, I've read The Gift of Fear. I know that you have to trust your instinct feeling about people, and I trust Robin's.
It takes me back to chapter 45 of Troubled Blood when she specifically thinks about how Strike has never done that to her.
Yeah.
Puts his hand, you know, God. You can see the good ones and you can see the bad ones. This Tayo is...
He's a bad one. This instinctive dislike is the same feeling that Robin and everyone else experiences towards Mazu, the sort of crawling sensation that this person is just wrong. So, like mother, like son?
Mazu's creepiness, I think, is a little more interesting to me, just mm-hmm. because Tayo's is so understandable. It's very much, he's a sexual predator, mm-hmm. warning signs going off. Mazu is just...
Yeah.
Creepy. Creepy in a weird, creepy.
Yeah.
Unexplained. That's what it is. It's unexplainable creepy when mm-hmm. Tayo's is like, oh, well, obviously.
We've seen this gross shit before. You know, we know.
So there's this paragraph here where Robin thinks about the previous night. Murphy stayed over and there had been lots of talk about the risks of going undercover. Clearly, now that he's found out, she'll be there for more than just the retreat part. He needs to share his wisdom. I don't really think that I had initially read this in the negative light that I'm kind of reading it in now. But the way Robin thinks that she was thankful she hadn't told him about the spirit bonding, it implies to me that maybe this talk had been a little condescending.
Mm-hmm.
The full line, Robin was neither ignorant nor arrogant enough to think that she stood in no need of advice. But her last thought before falling asleep was, thank God I didn't tell you about the spirit bonding.
Yeah, condescending was the word that came to mind after reading that part as well.
Okay, good.
Yeah. Because she knows she could use advice, but it sounds like the advice that Murphy's giving her here is probably stuff that's not particularly helpful or encouraging, like stuff that's pretty obvious. For some reason, it's giving me shades of Nick suggesting Strike write down Greg's obvious business suggestions and silkworm.
That made me like Nick.
That made me like Nick. Pearls of wisdom.
Yeah. Just jumping ahead to the next chapter, there is this part where it says, Murphy had said, listen, in exactly that tone on Friday night, 5 minutes after ejaculating and immediately before embarking on his prepared speech about the risks of going under deep cover.
I don't think that I'll ever stop laughing about this conversation being described as happening 5 minutes after ejaculating. That's a very romantic description, isn't it?
I noticed that he waited until he got off to risk pissing her off by lecturing her about undercover shit.
Interesting.
Right? He waited until mm-hmm. after they had sex, you know, then he can start lecturing her in case she takes it bad.
Interesting point.
I see what you did there, Murphy.
It just kind of tells me how the conversation went. I'd be very interested to know if Murphy's ever been undercover before.
I would too. I really would.
I don't know. I just felt like Robin was probably being lectured a bit.
Yeah, and I hate being lectured.
So after the service, Robin is again approached by the blonde, and Tayo also joins. But this is when it happens. She's invited to Chapman Farm. She only has 6 days until the bus leaves, right?
Yes.
Oh, it's terrifying for me. I'm just constantly blown away by Robin's bravery because I would be dreading this. I'd be so scared, but I don't think she's either of those things.
No.
The fact that she's not even like a little bit scared, she's my hero. I love her.
But here's where we get Tayo calling Robin a receptive, which we've talked about before in relation to the I Ching and this book's epigraphs. But I'm guessing that Tayo's definition of receptive is basically any woman I want to sleep with who doesn't immediately slap my hands away from her.
Yeah.
I don't want to compare him to a prey animal because those animals don't deserve that comparison. They're lovely. He's not a shark because sharks are really nice, but it's like he's sniffing sharks around really in this nice. Church for blood, right?
Sorry.
Well, I know you like sharks, so I don't want to insult sharks in front of you.
I do like sharks, but it's just to say sharks are really nice. Not like really. You guys got to get to know them.
You got to get to know them. I'd be the idiot in Meg too, making friends with the giant fucking shark.
I saw a TikTok the other day of this woman who believes she can talk to trees. I almost sent it to you.
Ew, because I'd be like, yeah, okay, I get that.
But that's what you reminded me of.
I'm just saying that it's like he's scenting blood in the water and then this church is this pool, right? But no insult to sharks intended. I think his motivation for trying to recruit Rowena here is very clear. He's not subtle.
Yeah, I agree. Like I said, I was instantly worried about him in regards to spirit bonding stuff.
Ugh.
I knew it was coming. Ugh. We all did.
We all saw that. This line makes me laugh, though, because the blonde says she thinks that Rowena will go pure spirit really fast. And I'm like, oh, you know, you should meet Strike because He's got the fastest pure spirit potential, because the joke he makes later.
Say it, because I don't remember.
It's like he makes a joke where Robin, when he says he's going to go to Olympia Stadium to see the races, and she's like, no, you can't do that, something something. He's like, oh, typical materialist thinking. Personally, I think I'll go pure spirit very fast. Right? And it was funny, because and now
it is funny.
Yeah. Sorry, delivery did not go well.
I'm sorry. But I am betting that they say that to everyone, though, to get them all excited joining.
It's like, oh, yeah, you'll definitely go pure spirit.
Everyone will go pure
spirit. It's like MLM recruiters. Oh, you'll definitely sell a million berries and reach the top of the pyramid so quick.
We also see a couple other people mentioned here, Giles Harmon and Dr. Zhao.
The comparison of them in this chapter with Noli, so her pretend humility because she loves attention and the image of her is good, versus these men's clear enjoyment of the status and power the church gives them. That's reflected in the different behaviors coming into the pews. It's very well done, and it absolutely sets the stage for what we learn about all of these principles later, I think.
It sets the stage, and I was just terrified.
Yeah, we're all very scared.
We're all scared.
Oh,
yeah. This moment.
We're almost near the end of part one. Shit's about to get real. Robin calls Strike at the end of this chapter and says, I'm in. And I can't help but think of a hacker. And I'm like, get out, Robin. Get back out. But we got to do it.
I know. Okay, so what are we doing in our next episode?
All right. In our next episode, we are doing chapters 20 through 22. And in these chapters, we hear from Midge and Dev, who share some intel about the area around Chapman Farm, and Strike and Robin interview Neve Doherty.
That'll do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy what you've heard, don't forget to follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr at the SE Files Pod. You can also contact us on our website at thesefilespod.com or email us directly at sefilespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much again for listening, and we hope to catch you next time for another episode of the Strike and Ellicott Files.